Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Salir Report. It's our quarterly review with the Saker. We love to do this. Our topic today is the umbrella topic I gave it was the unraveling continues because the shift to the multipolar world is clearly happening. So, Saker, you've been very busy this quarter, and I suspect it's even going to get busier, but you've published and written a lot. So welcome to the Salir Report. It's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure every time.
So I don't even know if I should call it the withdrawal from Syria, but I want to start with the U.S. changes of policy in Syria, whatever exactly they are. So tell us what's happened in Syria over the last quarter and what it means.
Well, I think we can say the U.S. withdrawal or from Syria, or we could almost say the loss of U.S. influence in the entire Middle East, because Syria really was the climax of U.S. attempts to, you know, reform and make a new Middle East, and basically every single effort that the U.S. made failed. And the situation in Syria gradually became so bad that I don't think it's, you know, it's not an issue whether the U.S. withdrawal will be complete or whether some will stay. I don't see a policy here. I've been saying that for a long time. This is not a policy. It's just purely reactive. So what we saw is, on one hand, basically an admission that the West's generally, that entire empire's plans failed. And that's why we had newspapers like Germany, I think it was Stern, or another one, who basically said, wrote about the collapse, the complete failure of the West, and that is a really important thing, because the Middle East is somewhere we could see it as the center of the world, and there is extremely obviously there's resources there, also a volatile situation, an extremely dangerous situation with nuclear weapons there, being held by states which are engaged in different levels of war. And basically, and the U.S. was by far the biggest power, you know, that could really decide things there. And that entire policy collapsed. And yeah, it was the Der Spiegel who wrote, you know, the capitulation of the West. The West did indeed, I think, capitulate. The West Empire did capitulate to an alliance of regional powers. I think that's a huge development.
Well, So let me ask several questions. One of the debates or the issues was that ISIS fighters who had been captured were now somehow released. Is that the case?
That is a big canard used by both sides, actually, to try to. The Kurds were trying to play a card with it. The U.S. was trying to do that. But this was basically just a wrapper around the important elements on the ground. And the important element is that basically the Syrian army recovered an immense amount of territory without almost firing a shot. Now they're fighting a little bit. Right. But I mean, it was a huge victory. And this entire idea that the ISIS fighters, you know, would be all running around free, it was more an attempt to try to find an argument to try to keep the Kurds in charge, and that obviously failed.
So then we see Erdogan sort of flexing his muscles and saying he's moving in. So what did Turkey do?
I think Turkey did what everybody knew that Turkey would do. I mean, everybody has been predicting that for several years already. And the Turks have always said, you know, we're not going to accept the creation of any kind of independent Kurdistan in northern Syria. This is a threat to us, and if this problem is not solved, we'll move in. Well, the Kurds were warned over and over and over about that. Their best and only chance was, of course, to side with Syrian government forces. And as soon as the Turks moved in, that's exactly what they suddenly start considering. It took right. that Turkish move to get them to be serious about negotiating with Damascus. And the beauty of that is that it's pretty clear that the Russians, first and foremost, but also the Iranians, let the Turks do that. The Russians have, the Russian air defense assets are actually concentrated in the north of Syria. And there was even an incident reported at that one moment that a pair of Turkish F-16s were intercepted, or not even intercepted, but they saw Russian Sukhoi 35s coming in and they had to turn back. So it looks like the Russians basically carefully, I would say, tuned that operation to get the maximum political bang and the minimal in terms of destruction and violence and, you know, actual shooting. So, and I think it worked.
So then we see Trump say that, you know, he wants the Syrian oil. And the implications being that we have enough troops on the ground to keep working certain oil fields. So what was the truth there?
Well, first of all, and this is a crucial thing that I always repeat, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel do not have a credible boots-on-the-ground force. They have a very bad time as soon as they engage somebody who's capable and willing of resisting, like the Syrians or the Iranians or Hezbollah. So this entire boots-on-the-ground thing, there is a reason why the U.S. evacuated when the Turks start coming in. And it's not that they're so so powerful. And the Turks were pretty easy about it. I mean, even there were an incident where they actually fired, or two incidents where they fired at U.S. Forces. So that's silly. Secondly, just yesterday, the Syrian news agency Sana published photographs. They're already part of the oil rigs are already passing over to the Syrian government forces. So it's unclear how much of these oil rigs, where they're located, how much of those are still, quote unquote, protected by the United States. But it's probably going to go to nothing. And how would they export from there? I mean, they're going to be tracked by everybody. Right. Everybody will see it. I think it was just Trump's usual bluster.
You had a great interview that you published of Assad in October, and I just want to, I used a quote on the commentary from it. I say that Trump is the best American president, not because his policies are good, but because he is the most transparent president. Trump talks transparently, saying that what he wants is oil. That is the reality of American policy, at least since World War II.
He's right.
I thought it was, yeah. No, I thought it's, if you look at the transparency that Trump is bringing, good, bad, or ugly, it's definitely stirring the pot. You know, we seem to be getting closer to having a real discussion about what's really going on. So, but
you know,
that was a very interesting interview.
I will say something in defense of Trump here. You know, I'm very critical of many stuff that he does, but the point is, he did not go to war in Syria so far. He might do it in the future. I'm not, never say never. So far, he hasn't done anything like that. He has not gone to war with the DPRK. He has not gone to war with Iran. He has not gone to war with Venezuela. And he's not going to war for Syria. Now, again, this might change. But I prefer a president who has a lot of, you know, bluster and silly macho statements, but who doesn't start wars, than a very slick salesman who pretends to be, you know, peace-loving and you know, a very democratic person. And then suddenly, this guy starts wars all over the place. I think there's something to be said objectively that Trump did right. And what he did right, he did not start these wars yet.
Right. Although, you know, it's, if you look at how many soldiers he took out of Syria, literally the next week he put more than that into Saudi Arabia. So it's not that our net commitment to the Middle East has dropped in terms of numbers of soldiers.
Yeah, but you know, these numbers of soldiers are, first of all, they're kind of irrelevant because there are already a very large forces there, and it makes no difference. I mean, what have these forces achieved? And adding a couple of thousand men, you know, it's purely PR, militarily speaking. In the Middle East, there are really two levels which are completely different. One is what the public is told and what is shown, and it's all, you know, a kabuki of messages sent left and right. And then there's a military reality. For instance, the Israelis, my favorite example is the Israelis who say that they bombed Syria hundreds of times. Well, where is the result on the ground from all these bombings? Because there's something tangible that actually was achieved.
Didn't they kill a lot of civilians?
Well, yeah, but that's militarily, that's useless. You can kill as many civilians as you want. That does not give you any, it will not impact. If anything, it just strengthens the result of the other side. We've seen that over and over and over. But in terms of achieving something, the Israeli Air Force, what it did in Syria, whatever, you know, we'll never know exactly because most of that is kept very highly secret. But the point is, it made no military difference. And then when the Russian Air Force started operating in Syria, it made a difference. Well, you know, there's a reason for that, because there's always those two levels. And what Trump did, what sending those troops to Saudi Arabia, it's just, you know, a macho kabuki. Oh, we're going to stand by our allies. And that's it. But there's nothing happening, really.
But if you go back to 9/11 and the seven countries in 5-year plan, for some reason they wanted to control seven countries in 5 years and basically get them into, you know, it's their version of the central banking system. And and they spent many, many years, $7 trillion that we know of, I'm sure more covertly, and all they managed to do is create a huge mess.
Well, I think it's even much more serious than just saying it's a mess. Because if you look, the real core reason for the tensions and hostility between Israel and Iran, from the Israeli point of view, I never believed, and I still don't believe, that Iran had or has or will have a nuclear weapons program. And I believe that the Israelis know exactly that this is not true. But the real problem that they have with Iran is that it is an Islamic republic, which is openly defying, you know, the Anglo-Zionist empire, openly denouncing Israeli policies in Palestine, and getting away with it and actually being successful. And Iran, sort of, the Israelis, when this entire, seven countries in 5 years program began, the real target was always Tehran, and the real target, the real goal of the Israelis was to hit Iran so hard that Iran would not have that status of local power. Well, look what happened. Iran is now, beyond any doubts, the number one power in the Middle East. All of this entire plan gave Iran, removed Saddam Hussein, the biggest enemy of Iran, gave Iran a big chunk of sympathetic forces in Syria, right, in Lebanon, etc. It's a complete failure of the crucial objective of controlling Iran.
So how are the sanctions impacting Iran now?
That I don't know, because I hear completely contradictory things. I think sanctions do have an impact, and from what I understand, the sanctions on Iran are extremely hard. But Iran is trying to move out from that zone and sort of move into economic ties with Russia and China to try to sort of stay out of the U.S. controlled zone. But my understanding is that, of course, there is a rare, very real impact, but not enough to stop anything.
Right. To me, this comes down to the relationship. You know, you've written, I think, very eloquently about the growing ties between Russia and China. But if Russia and China can create payment mechanisms to trade with Iran without the dollar system being able to bite, and they're willing to do it, you know, that's going to be, basically, we're engineering Iran into their arms, but that's going to be, you know, the saving grace. That's, to me, that's the only way they ultimately economically thrive, given the sanctions.
I completely agree with you. I always say, for instance, that I'm a big supporter of sanctions against Russia, and I want them to be, you know, stricter, because these sanctions help Russia move out of the sphere controlled by the U.S.
Right,
and
absolutely.
Makes Russia do the right things. And yes, indeed, Russia, China, Iran, Turkey, by the way, also is participating into that, and India. So all these states are trying to find mechanisms to use either local currencies or just some way of bypassing the systems which are controlled by the West.
Right. You're going to turn Russia into an agricultural juggernaut. So I'll tell you a very little interesting factoid. One of the reasons that Russia has been able to really start to build a much more self-sufficient economy is the rape of Russia resulted in Russia not having any debt and not being able to access the debt markets. And so, ugly as it was, it got them off the debt model, and that put them in a position to then build, you know, to build more self-sufficiency with the sanctions. So the more America has done to harm Russia, the stronger Russia gets in terms of its model.
Yes,
very
so
interesting
far,
to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, there's no denying.
So I have to turn to one of the bright spots in the last 3 months of news. Netanyahu lost the election and failed to put together a coalition government and is now waiting to hear whether or not he's going to be indicted. I have no idea, you know, if that would be great news to see Netanyahu indicted.
Yeah, but well, indicted for, he used to be indicted for the right reasons, and unfortunately that's not going to happen. I mean, first and foremost, he is guilty of the ultimate crime in international law, which is the crime of aggression.
Right.
And but that's right. Literally the entire Israeli society is guilty of that. So but right. really, he or another guy, it's not going to get better over there.
Well, if you have another guy, will another guy have the networks? I mean, part of the problem is Israel's not Israel. Israel networks into a whole, international network of people who want to own big equity positions on the Silk Road and in the, in the global economy and make money on the national security state and on and on and on. And Netanyahu was for many decades very seriously networked and had very strong relationships with everybody. I don't think whoever replaces him is going to have the kind of relationships with the big money guys in Beverly Hills that Netanyahu had.
One devil is the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. I mean, the changes were not very in the past, and sometimes you have Labor coming to power and being actually more aggressive than Likud. So it's very, well, there's not much hope.
So Israel is left. I'm talking totally as a bystander, just observing. But it seems to me if I was Israel, I would feel very, very afraid, because you've basically made a huge mess politically in the United States. You've created huge anger throughout the... In other words, you were really the leader of this 7-country in 5 years, and you've been... My guess is you've been in violation massively of many international laws many, many times. You've just been the bull in the China shop, and you've been able to talk the Americans into doing, amazing things, and now you're just hanging out there, and the plan failed, and you're a little guy sitting in the Middle East, and you've got a lot of people fed up with you.
Yeah, and if you look at your sort of ally, i.e. Saudi Arabia, they're now clearly courting Russia and trying to get Russia to provide assurances, guarantees, or technology, or military systems. And they're trying to make Russia a partner, because they also know the writing on the wall. For the Israelis, talking to Russia is easy, but the other thing that they're really cannot do is talk to Iran, and this is what they should do. Because of their ideology. Their ideology makes it absolutely impossible for them to admit that they're not the greatest, smartest, biggest, and sole democracy of the Middle East and superpower. All the rest of that's racist nonsense that they believe in. And Iran, if they went to negotiate with Iran, they would have to admit that their policy of "we can strike anybody anytime" didn't work. They have been in violation of international law for decades. They're by far the state that's complete, rogue state that openly has only contempt for international law and pretty much the rest of the planet. This is not, a good negotiating position. So if you can't, just terrorize everybody by unleashing out violence, then you don't have anything left. What will they negotiate with? What would be their negotiating position? They're in a really bad situation now because exactly as you said, their grand strategy has completely collapsed. That's huge.
Well, it's funny, and this one of the reasons I go back to this Assad quote. I believe the Israelis interfered massively with the U.S. elections, and it was why Trump won. And yet Trump's transparency and the canard about the Russians engineering the election has really brought out a massive amount of, information and background about how the Israelis and that network do engineer elections. And if anything, and Trump hasn't given them their war. So, I wonder if the strategy of backing Trump is working for them. It's going to be interesting. Okay. So let's turn to the Ukraine. Tell us, U.S. politics aside, what is really going on the ground in Ukraine now?
Well, what's going on is something extremely interesting and in a way tragic, because Zelensky, he was elected with a huge mandate of the people. I mean, he had total control. And clearly, the will of the people was to stop the war is the first thing. And then there was this big issue. Can he take the first initial steps to start building some kind of mechanism to finally act on the Minsk Agreement and the Steinmeier formula? And what we saw is that a comic, you know, who can be very brilliant in a stand-up comedy, just is not made to be a leader. Basically, he was speaking from both sides of his mouth. He tried to get some stuff done and did. I mean, there was an exchange of prisoners that worked. But the first step of the implementation, the separation of forces, it's been now several weeks and it's still going on. And it appears that basically he doesn't have control really of the situation. And it's kind of, there's no state right now functioning there. So there's no policy either. There's a complete collapse. I think the Ukraine is in free fall right now.
Really?
And the key problem is that they, again, like the Israelis, for ideological reasons, they cannot negotiate directly with the Novorossians. Their thesis has always been, and it's Russia, 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 Russia. But to actually get anything done, you need to talk to the locals. And they are not willing to do that. And those who are willing to do that, some of them are. I mean, there's some pretty smart politicians there. But the problem is that they're immediately denounced as traitors, as agents of Putin. And they're actually, you can be charged with criminal, you face criminal charges for even saying that you have to negotiate with these people.
Well, it's increasingly looking like there are more people who want to fight than eat. So
I think they're different people. The majority wants to eat and a minority wants to fight, but the minority which wants to fight has the guns. And the other, the majority doesn't have guns. That's the real tragedy.
So let's go to U.S. politics, because we finally, it took us 2.5 years to realize that the idea of the Russians rigging the elections was absurd. And everyone knew it all along, but that was sort of the tactic that the Democrats were going to use to impeach Trump, and it didn't work and it failed. And if anything came out, there's a real case that there were serious laws broken trying to package it together and get it to work. So now we have a new one, and that is a whistleblower who's accusing Trump of inappropriate behavior vis-a-vis getting the Ukraine to investigate what to me looks like Biden's multiple law breakings vis-a-vis the Ukraine and his son Hunter Biden. So tell us about the Ukraine and U.S. politics. What in the world is going on?
What is going on is exactly what you said, is that the Ukraine is used again by the Democrats to try to remove Trump from power by saying that he did something inappropriate. Well, if you look at the summary of the conversation, I don't think that we ever were shown that there was a word by word transcript made. But from what the transcript which was released, I certainly don't see anything wrong by asking a country what the citizens of the United States are doing there. I mean, it's been done by all countries. They all exchange that kind of information. That's not no big deal. It's basically an attempt. There's nothing original here. An attempt to, again, accuse, find a way to say not my president and reject him and try to hurt him in the next elections. I think that's all the Democrats want. They know that the impeachment is not going to pass the Senate, don't they?
Yeah, no, I think they do. Although you have real dissatisfaction with Trump among some of the moderate Republicans. And if you look at all the moderate Republicans who are resigning, they're resigning for multiple reasons. But I think there's a part of the Republican Party who's frustrated with Trump's, and they have some legitimate complaints. So Trump can be his own worst enemy. And if you look at the situation with Ukraine, I just have to tell you, there was a way to handle it that wouldn't expose him. He did it in a way that exposed him. And, he wasn't thinking smart, is what it looks like to me.
Well, to be honest, I think in most cases, Trump doesn't come across as very smart. But all the grievances that I hear against him, including my own, by the way, I have a long list of stuff I'm not happy with him, they're political. Political grievances are not a reason to engage in impeachment.
Right.
That's what's so shocking to me. I mean, I'm appalled to see that the Democrats are actually willing to break the laws, the laws of this country, right, for purely political gain. I mean, they're hurting the country while trying to hurt Trump. That's ridiculous. I mean, I really am shocked by that. I really am.
Well, so I was sitting in Europe trying to understand what in the world was going on, but I was in the Netherlands, then Switzerland, then France, and everywhere I went, as you watched it, it seemed like they had, you know, I don't know how to describe it, they either lost their minds or they were regressing to childhood. In other words, these were people who were incapable. The political process had lost its ability to deal with the real problems. And so all they could do was fight over control and make things up so that they could fight over control. And now, if you look below the surface, there are a lot of things going on that indicate to me that the people who are really running the bureaucracy are moving ahead and dealing with real problems very silently and secretly. But, you know, Congress has been cut out of voting for the wars. It's been cut out of voting for appropriations now with FASB 56. You know, if you look at something like the Paris Agreement, it's been cut out of the treaties. I mean, what exactly does Congress do? If it doesn't appropriate, if it doesn't vote for the wars, and it doesn't, you know, approve the treaties, what does it do?
Well, mostly, I think it's in business of impeaching presidents now. That's what they've been most active at. Have they done anything of really, truly importance? When is the last time Congress passed something really relevant that actually would make a difference here?
October 4th, 2018, the General Accounting Office, now called General Accountability Office, acting on behalf of Congress and the Office of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, adopted FASB 56 and completely turned the entire management of money by the federal government, you know, 180 degrees. It was one of the biggest, you know, things that Congress and the White House have done in 100 years. You know, it's almost as big as going to war in World War II. And what they basically said is the executive branch can spend whatever they want, however they want, and they can keep it secret, and they can keep it secret from us, is my interpretation of it. And if you look at that exact moment, you know, we now see massive changes, and I think the Ukraine story is in the middle of it, because if you look at the groups of people who I believe were laundering the money that was being pulled out, because remember, we got $21 trillion missing, and that money went missing during Clinton, Bush, and Obama, with the biggest pots going missing during Obama. You know, if you look at who was the number one donor to the Clinton Foundation, it was the Ukraine. I think they were just laundering a whole bunch of that money through the Ukraine. But as soon as they passed FASB 56, I think it was Jeffrey Epstein's death knell, because he was a critical part of those networks. So, you know, and you're watching a cleanup of those networks happening one way or another, and the fighting that's going on covertly. We now have nine New York policemen who've been suicided. I don't know if that's 9/11 or the Wiener laptop or Epstein, but you know, there's a street war going on, Saker, that is very hard to understand or see. And I think, you know, I think when FASB 56 passed, Jeffrey Epstein was a dead man. But, you know, this is a very revolutionary change, because what it says is the White House can do whatever it wants secretly, globally. I mean, it's an infinite amount of secret money for secret armies.
But really, it's not just the White House. It's basically, first of all, through that process, it's cleaning up that you're mentioning, we see that there is no separation of power in the country anymore. They're not keeping each other in check. They're working together hand in hand. Congress votes itself out of its own powers and oversight authority. So what we're seeing is that basically that the only possible conclusion from that is that the real power is neither in the Congress nor in the White House, somewhere else. And that's helpful, actually. Again, that's sort of in the same trend as when the concept of the 1% came out. Of course, the real power is much below 1%. But conceptually, this is correct. It shows that there's a power of a tiny minority. And again, we see that again. So the real question is, who's running the country here? And exactly, they're showing their true face by their actions. And that's, I think, a very good development.
Right. Well, I think there are two things going on. One is, I think the reason Congress and Trump are talking about things that are irrelevant is because the real power is left, exactly as you say. So now what FASB 56 has done is it's turned over complete power to the deep state, and the question who are they? And the who question is very important, because one of the things we're seeing as soon as that passed is we're seeing a whole bunch of people fall. So Weinstein, Epstein, all sorts of stories come out on Google, Facebook, now ABC News / Walt Disney, whistleblowers. And you definitely, you know, it definitely looked to me looks like the pilgrims, as Cynthia McKinney would say, are very much going after the Ziocons. And there's a real political struggle here, because my guess is this gives the FASB 56 gives the sort of deep state and particularly the central bankers a lot more power and control, because now the people who run the central bank can absolutely control the bureaucracy on the fiscal side.
Well, the good news is that when there is a crisis, and there's most definitely a crisis now of the empire, a profound one, the elites who typically run the country that's in a crisis turn on each other. And right. So there what we see very, very nasty fights taking place between various groups, but that all brings them to the surface. And that's a very helpful again.
Right. Well, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like the people who were leading 10 years ago are going at each other with knives. And it's far from over. And that's one of the reasons that 2020 elections, even though the people running don't have the power to really change things, they do have the power to bring transparency to things. And that's, let me just skip ahead and ask you about Tulsi Gabbard, because she is one person who's trying to bring real transparency on the real issues.
Personally, I find her. I like her very much. I like most of what she says, not all. She also had a moment when she was trying to prove that she's not a Russian agent and release some silly ads. And she did vote once on a Zionist resolution, which sort of left me unhappy with her. I would say, by and large, she's heading in the right direction. She, for instance, recently said that there should be all the secret documents about 9/11 should be released because of Al-Qaeda and the attacks. So she didn't quite go into the truther camp, but she at least raised the possibility of an investigation. I think she's distinctly different from everybody else so far. I wouldn't endorse her, but I'm watching her with great interest, and particularly what fascinates me is the way the liberal media reacts to her. I mean, you have a woman who is an ethnic minority, who is a liberal, and who served in the military. I mean, what? She would be the perfect candidate. I mean, if the Democratic Party was really what it pretends to be, they would immediately, you know, endorse her, make her run, and she would do terrifically. But no,
right?
They're turning against her, bashing her more than the Republicans do. That tells you a lot about what the Democratic Party has become today.
Well, everybody, with rare exception, is on board for more war. And it's interesting, one of the reasons Trump won was because he promised he wouldn't be like that. And he certainly talked war, but if you look at what he's done, he's been able to pull back from really going, you know, the people who backed him, they're not getting the war that they wanted. And but the dependency on wasteful war is just off the charts. And Tulsi Gabbard is the only person bringing that up and trying to get people to face it. Well, let me turn to Nord Stream, because a lot of what we're watching are the politics of energy. And energy is very interesting now because the prices, you know, for the places in the world, and it's far from every place that can do renewables, the prices are dropping dramatically. The shale prices are dropping. The U.S. is trying to be more energy independent. So the energy position is shifting, but the dollar is still very much tied to the trade and the energy. So when you talk energy, you not only talk about the energy and the price of energy, but you're talking about the currency. So we see the final, I think there are final approvals going forward for Nord Stream 2, because Russia has enormous oil and gas. And Russia's ability to deliver that gas to Germany and Europe is critical. So tell us about pipeline politics. What's happening now?
Well, I think that's critical, first and foremost, for Europe, because European gas extraction is going down, and they want a reliable and cheap solution for the energy needs. But for Russia, I think the future is in the south and the east in terms of energy policy, because that's where I think the economy will eventually be the most active, the strongest growing, etc. So I think the policy of, it's far more important for Europe to achieve that Nord Stream 2 than it was for Russia.
Isn't it mostly Germany?
Yes, because the European economy, right, is mostly Germany.
Right. I don't know if you saw it. There's an announcement that Germany is planning on doubling its budget for the EU.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. So if Brexit really continues to happen, Germany's just going to keep emerging as the clear leader of Europe.
Yeah, but they have a political problem, is that they don't, they still are very, very much under the US thumb, more than, right, than the French, for instance. And I think, look at the German political leaders, I don't think any of them have, you know, credibility, because Europe desperately needs a new generation of politicians to start finally looking after European national interest and not just, you know, sheepishly executing whatever order comes out of DC. And that's not happening yet. Right now, Europe is also in complete disarray because of that. I mean, somewhere the Europeans, the Israelis, and the Kurds, they all made the same mistake. They completely relied for their future on the United States. And the U.S. defaulted on all three. And now all three are in a very, very serious crisis. And it's going to be extremely hard to you know, change course and act on past mistakes.
Well, the question that keeps coming up, whether wherever you are, I mean, it all year long, it came up when I was in Asia, it came up when I was in Europe, it came up with the United States, which is, who's really doing this? Who's really in control? Because it's, you know, it's so patently obvious that the government officials, I'll never forget being in Italy and somebody saying, you know, they run, we elect them, and then they do what the last guy did, and it was a complete waste of time. And what we want to know is who's really running things. So that's, to me, one of the good things about Trump, because he's getting people asking about the real questions.
Yes.
Like, who's really running this? Yeah.
And I would say the same thing in Europe. I mean, the disaster of the immigration crisis proved suddenly that European leaders are completely unable to you know, stand up for their own obvious self-interest. They're executing, right, somebody else's agenda. So that sense, right, of being ruled by a small top elite, I call them the nomenclatura. You know, the Soviet Union had, it was actually a list of officials which were considered, you know, part of the official state elite. Well, that's what we have in the West. The West is run by a class, not by a group of people. It's a class. It's a nomenclatura that's transnational and acts on a very, very specific ideology and worldview, which is not at all what the people in the West elect these people to do.
Well, you almost wonder if they just don't have the time or the tolerance to understand the, you know, the world and all of its complexity. So, you know, the easiest thing to do is just centralize control and let everybody, you know, live with whatever the damage done by a model that's too centrally controlled and too simple. Well, let's turn to the Russians, because the Russians have been working hard to build new weapons. And I try and watch and understand the debate about what weapons people really have. And frankly, you know, if there was one piece of intelligence I wish I had, is an accurate briefing of who has what weapons and what the state of play is in the weaponry. But that's your background and expertise. So talk about what the Russians have been doing in terms of military prowess and what it means to the balance of power.
Well, the most interesting thing that happened with Russia is that with a relatively small military budget, I believe it's, depending on how you calculate it, it's less than a tenth of what the U.S. has. Russia has deployed some very, very sophisticated weapons, and in all sorts of different fields, ranging from, you know, strategic strike drones to fifth generation fighters to advanced air defense systems to hypervelocity missiles and coastal defense systems. I mean, it's very impressive to see the quality of what Russia produces now. The problem with Russia is the quantity. And she still has a hard time having the, you know, sufficient, because now Russia had to produce pretty much everything with import substitution. So the sanctions hurt the Russian military too, by the way. And the right. severance of contracts with the Ukraine was bad for Russia. But Russia has actually recovered. Does a remarkable job. And now it's just a matter of quantity.
And so what does it mean to, you have Russia drawing closer to China and doing a variety of different agreements with China, and then Russia becoming sort of the new peacemaker in the Middle East. What do the weapons contribute to making those two things happen or improving Russia's standing in the world?
I think it's a combination of several things. Definitely that Russian weapons are actually designed to fight and win, and not just to make somebody rich through military budgets, but also Russian commitment to their allies. I mean, the way Russia literally saved Syria is something that everybody in the region noticed. It's in very sharp contrast to U.S. guarantees to their allies. So it's a combination of these two things, the political will and the weapon systems, which are actually very, very effective. The reputation of U.S. Weapon system has been vastly exaggerated by a very efficient propaganda machine. But when push comes to shove, and actually there's an enemy on the other side that has reasonable capabilities and is willing to fight, you suddenly see that they're not miracle weapons at all, as we saw by the strikes on Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Even the Houthis could do that. And they're supposedly a weak party in the region compared to, you know, the multi-billion military budgets that Israel or Saudi Arabia has, or the United Arab Emirates, or all of them. Yet they're succeeding because they're basically, in their case, it's mostly Iranian weapons and Iranian know-how and advice. But the Iranians seem to be doing pretty well against the U.S. in that standoff.
So are you willing, can you say a little bit about what you've written about the Russian-Chinese partnership and why it's unique?
It's unique because there is no formal alliance as of yet. Instead of entering a treaty or creating some kind of organization, Russia and China basically started, I think, took the fundamental strategic decision to act as symbionts in a symbiotic relationship. Russia provides China exactly what China needs, and China provides Russia what she needs. And the combination of the two, it's like, you know, little puzzle pieces. It's a perfect fit. And I think what we're having here is something that I can't think of a previous example in history. Two ex-empires, which basically decide to go into a symbiotic relationship, but one which is not, at least for the time being, spelled out in the text of a formal treaty or alliance. It's actually a deeper relationship, I would argue.
Right. It's a very practical relationship.
Yes. For instance, Russia right now has offered China to help built anti-ballistic missile systems around the Chinese capital. So we're talking about extremely advanced projects. They're working together on airliners. These are huge prospects for collaboration. And I think it's just going to get deeper and deeper.
Right. And it's happening financially, too. So we see, you know, creation of offices in the two places that can swap gold and do other very meaningful transaction things. So What it looks like to me is that they're completely focused on highly practical, you know, project by project, step by step things. And the interesting thing about that kind of partnership, when you're helping each other get something done on all the practical needs you have day to day to day, is you end up building a web that's very hard to tear apart.
Yes.
In other words, you have so many interdependencies in a practical way, and you do it so quietly that it's a real sort of merger of interests, and it's very, very hard to tear apart.
I think that's absolutely crucial. The future, you know, very vertical pretend alliances like NATO, where it's basically run by one party, I think are a thing of the past. And if you think about the Cold War, for instance, the Soviets and the United States, they played a zero-sum game. Anything good for one side was considered bad by the other. After the Cold War, I think the U.S. stayed in that paradigm mentally. The Chinese and the Russians did something different. Instead of trying to oppose the U.S. at every single point on the planet, they decided to instead build in their own little part of the world an alternative, an economic alternative, a political alternative, a military alternative. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a multipolar world emerging, which is not directly challenging the empire. It's just offering us up an alternative. And that's very, very powerful and hard to stop.
Well, to me, the most important part is the prospering of the Russian Orthodox Church. Because if anybody is protecting and nurturing Christianity globally, it's the Russians. Is that not true?
I would say that this is a simplification of reality. Russia, I think, is protecting officially and very openly the rights of people and ethnic groups and religious groups to have their own civilizational model, their own values, and not be told, you know, that there's only one right way and one form of human rights. But I don't think it's necessarily Orthodox exclusively or even mainly, because Orthodoxy, there still is a minority of people in Russia that are, you know, profoundly religious. Most people see themselves, right, if Orthodox, then culturally Orthodox. So there is, I think, a strong sense of sympathy for generally conservative Christian traditional values in Russia. But I wouldn't put it as one religion, you know, or one country the sole defender of Christianity worldwide, because that's not quite the case.
Well, but I would say that Putin's been one of the few leaders openly defending traditional Judeo-Christian values. And what we've seen across most of the politicians in the West is an assault and an effort to destroy Judeo-Christian values.
Well, I'm not sure I know that there is something called Judeo-Christian values, but Christian values, I mean, the West is in a post-Christian phase already. Russia is different because Russia was under communist rule. Just in the same way as Russia during the Middle Ages, there was no really renaissance in Russia. These differences historically allowed Russia to not be yet a post-Christian society. I think it's a question mark where Russia is headed. And indeed, there's a true possibility that Russia will become, you know, a majority Christian country again, but it's still a process. We're not there yet. It's a moving target.
Okay, so let me turn to the 2020 campaign. Is it okay if I ask you questions about the 2020
Absolutely.
Campaign?
Absolutely.
Okay. So one of the things I find absolutely appalling is the extent to which the debate is on things which are irrelevant and off topic to what's really going on and what's really important. And one of the things we've decided to do is every week we're publishing a poster. We call it meme is My 21 2020. And the first poster was some young guy standing there saying, you know, as far as my student loan debt, take it out of the 21 trillion. And every week it's something that ties the 21 trillion back to pension funds not having money, or Flint not having a water system, or, you know, it's the one that's up this week is some really handsome black guy saying, I don't need affirmative action. I want the 21 trillion back. So it's to focus people on the financial aspects. So that's one issue. But I'm a great believer that real solutions require transparency. And I'm, for the first time in many, many years, I'm seeing an interest in more and more Americans in understanding what the real issues are. So for the 2020 campaign, I'm not saying elections are important in America, but they are a time when Americans get together and discuss. You know, it's an education process for many, many Americans because they spend so much time on it. So, Saker, what if we were going to try and inject into the 2020 campaign some real discussions about the really important issues, what would you recommend, you know, the top three would be? What would you inject into the discussion?
I think, first of all, the respect for the rule of law. And that's something that applies to the country inside, i.e. civil rights and you know, all the violation that we see now by the state of these rights, and international law. Because right now what I see is the United States has basically given up on both of them. And we're seeing just a law of the jungle on both levels. And that profoundly, I think, affects the country. So that would be one issue I would definitely bring is, you know, ask politicians straight to their face and, you know, hammer that in. That if something is illegal, you can't do it. And I think this is next to the topic of peace and imperialism, the two, I think, most important ones. Because the economy, the political system, everything here is, you know, relies completely on constant fear and warfare.
Right.
And that should be denounced because that's a key reason for the collapse.
Right. And it's getting worse, not better. And
yes.
It's interesting. So let's assume we'll either have Trump win the election or a Democratic candidate. We don't know who that would be. If the Democrats win, what's your expectation? If the war machine wants war, where will they go to war? How will they go to war? Because remember, they don't necessarily want war. They want war spending.
Yeah, but I think that if the Democrats win, there's going to be war in the Middle East. Because that's all they know how to do. They don't have any concept at all of negotiating. It's going to be war in the Middle East. I think that's a very, very serious danger. Unless it's Tulsi Gabbard, which I don't believe is going to happen. But all the other ones, their rhetoric is complete. It's messianic, it's supremacist, it's imperialist. It is every bit as sick as we have heard from the worst neocons. That's mainstream now.
Okay, so Hillary Clinton is saying she might run. Mm-hmm. I doubt it, but let's just pretend for a second that Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden becomes president, and they want war in the Middle East. What does war in the Middle East look like? I don't understand what that looks like other than dropping a nuclear bomb.
Well, no, there are other options in theory. For instance, the option the Israelis would want is to have a strong air campaign against Iran to quote-unquote disarm and, you know, take care of the nuclear program. In reality, destroy as much of their economy as possible and make the Iranian people pay for voting for the quote-unquote wrong people and supporting them. I think that was always been the biggest risk in the Middle East, and that still is a risk. And if that happens, the entire region would explode, I believe, immediately.
And if it explodes, what happens?
Eventually, yes, I do have to say, I don't think that the Israelis have the kind of military. I mean, if we go down that road, you're going to have Iran backed by Hezbollah, backed by the Houthis. There's going to be a very, very serious war locally. And the Israelis, I think, will use nuclear weapons in the last resort. And I don't think it's going to help them militarily at all. Because it's all fine and well to have nuclear weapons, but you need to be able to strike something that gives you a military advantage again, not just killing people.
Right.
Because killing, you know, if there's crazy enough to lob a nuke on Tehran, you know what's going to happen to Tel Aviv. And you don't need nukes to destroy a city or even invade a country completely. Israel really right now has to think about its survival as a country. And I think it's very much in doubt in the midterm.
Right. So midterm is what, 10 years?
Yes. I just don't see Israel as a viable entity in the Middle East at all, unless it completely changed its political culture. And that's not happening anytime soon.
Right. Well, it's interesting if you look at, you know, I mentioned all the different things that are rolling out in terms of FASB 56. But if the U.S. doesn't need lots of covert money laundering and covert operations that they used to get from Israel or related networks, it changes the power dynamic. And I don't think there's any way to understand which way it'll go except to see how events unfold. So we have a lot to watch for 2020. So the last question, Saker, before we go is, what I want to know is, how are you going to stay sane during the campaign?
Well, I thought I could just ignore it entirely, and that would be the best option. But ever since Tulsi Gabbard got involved, I'm still keeping an eye on her. And I am also, with horror, keeping an eye on the Democratic Party and its attempts to impeach Trump, or to use an impeachment procedure, more accurately, to hurt him. Because I think they're destroying the polity of the country here. And I think this is truly, truly tragic. And the fact that almost nobody in the media has a real serious problem with that tells us something about the media also. I mean, this country is in really bad shape. And I'm afraid for next year.
Yeah, no, and there's a serious problem at the top. And that's why I think it'll be interesting to see the way the sort of cleanup goes. Okay, I want to turn to your books for a second. One, you know, the major problem I have with your books, Acre, is I've read all three and I need another one. But first, tell us about you've written The Essential Sacre, The Essential Sacre 2, and then The Essential Sacre 3. They're all available on your website. So just talk a little bit about how the books are doing and how we get a hold of them.
They're doing well. You can get hold of them straight on my website, thesacre.is. Some of them are ready for free download, and the paper ones you can still order.
I just have to tell you the thing I love about them is they take you into all these different parts of the world, and you know you can't travel everywhere, but they take you into different parts of the world, and you see, you see the different cultures and policies and politics interacting at a very granular level, but it's human. And the stories are great. So if you want to understand the emerging multipolar world and you don't have time to get out and about and read thousands of pages, you know, it's a wonderful way to plug into a whole different way of looking at the world that is so much more compatible with understanding the world around us. And, you know, they're just a fun read. I couldn't put them down. And I think I told you the story about how one of them got stolen.
Yes, and you printed it or what, right? You tried printing the entire book.
So, you know, I was reading it on the plane coming back from LA. It was the third. And I was making notes all over the book, all the way. And I'd read everything but 100 pages. And I stopped to get, it was in my bean bag. And I stopped to get groceries on the way home from the plane. And the next morning, when I opened the bag, it was gone.
Well,
so I was at Kroger's for 30 minutes, and I thought, well, somebody really wants to know what I think about Sacre's. So the underlying parts were very, very important. So if you haven't read part 3 or The Essential Sacre 3, you need to read it. But first, read 1 or 2, and again, give your URL again, Sacre.
That's thesacre.is, as in Iceland.
Right. And I just have to make one other plug. Not only do I love your website and I love all the different articles, I love the community. I love the discussion. You have on the internet the richest discussion going of sort of the emerging multipolar world. And it's moderated. The moderation doesn't stop any of the authenticity or the, you know, the quality of the debate, but it does stop the trolls. And so the power of the conversation there is, it's enormously informative. So go check out Sacre's website. But when you do, drop down and start reading some of the comments, because it's really one of the most intelligent communities going on the internet. And I just want to thank you for it, because you make it all available. And I know it's a tremendous amount of work.
Yes, so. But the moderation, I owe it entirely to the head of moderation and the moderating team, which is entirely deserves the credit for all of that. Their work is extremely hard, and they get a lot of nastiness for doing it well. Right. So I also thank them deeply.
Well, but it, you know what it shows when you go to your website and you read the comments, what you realize is people really want to have a serious discussion. And if we have ways and forums where we can go have these serious discussions, we all learn and we get smarter and we get better. And, you know, we can solve all these problems, but it's going to take bringing transparency, and it's going to take an honest discussion. And I've learned a lot from reading the comments at your website, and they've really changed my mind on a whole bunch of issues. But
and also... You know, the guest authors that I have, I'm really lucky to have superb guest authors. It's almost every day there's an article by them.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so check out the website, get the books, and Sacre, we will talk to you next quarter. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about.
Probably, yes. We're living interesting times.
Yes. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, and you too. Bye-bye.